Good afternoon. I'm Alexis Keenan. We're just about 30 minutes away from the premiere of Yahoo Finance's first documentary film, Valley of Hype. It's a story about the world's youngest self-made female billionaire, Elizabeth Holmes, and how Silicon Valley startup culture played a role in the undoing of her and her company, Theranos. Prosecutors say she committed fraud against investors and patients. All told, she raised nearly $1 billion. Her trial begins tomorrow. She's pled not guilty to charges of wire fraud and conspiracy. In the film, we explore if any other parties aside from Holmes and her co-defendant Sunny Balwani should shoulder any of the blame for Theranos' downfall. First, to talk more about those questions, let's start by talking about the charges themselves. Reed Cathryne is a plaintiff's attorney who sued Holmes and Theranos early on. He represented late-stage investors who reached a settlement with Holmes and Theranos. He's also one of the very few people who has deposed Elizabeth Holmes. Reed, welcome.
Well, thank you for accommodating me. I'm in Denali National Park, and so I apologize that if there's any sound quality or something like that.
Well, thank you for being here first from so far away. So some people know Holmes' story, others do not. And your clients, their civil claims against Theranos, they were not so different from the federal government's criminal charges. So in a nutshell, why is it that Holmes is charged with financial fraud and also conspiracy?
Well, there's really two sets of charges against her. The financial fraud is defrauding the investors like our investors. And then there's the fraud against patients. I guess that's also financial fraud in that the patients paid for the blood tests. And both cases center around their claim to have developed these blood tests off of this machine about the size of an old Macintosh computer where you could just plug in a single drop of blood and it would analyze up to 120 different blood tests. They claimed it was working. In fact, they were using third-party equipment, and even then they were diluting it so that they could squeeze as much blood out of that little drop of blood, and the tests were inaccurate, and they were never working.
Now, most of Theranos' investors included wealthy individuals. There was Oracle's Larry Ellison, Tim Draper, the Walton family, just to name a few, plus VC firms, hedge funds, investment firms. So most of these investors didn't go after Holmes. So why is that exactly?
Well, most of the investors came on early on, and they all knew each other. You can see from what you just put up that they were all high political figures are tied into political figures within a certain party, and with involvement with the Hoover Institution. And so they all kind of knew each other. And I think when they realized that there might be problems with Theranos, they decided to put aside their differences and try and circle the wagons around there and still believing in Elizabeth Holmes, just make sure that one of them didn't go after what assets Theranos had, while the others sat on the sideline hoping things would work. That way, they sort of protected each other. On the other hand, they let the company continue to use up the resources it had and go down the tubes. I think they were true believers because they all knew each other. They trusted each other, and they all kind of trusted that the other person did the due diligence when, in fact, they did not.
So, Reed, some of what you just mentioned goes to the cultural aspects of Silicon Valley and that tight networking that exists not only at Stanford, at the Hoover Institution, but just among the tech community there and the generations that have existed in the tech community. So the judge here allowed Holmes to raise Silicon Valley culture, startup culture, that is, in her defense. So does that help her at all, in your opinion?
I think it might help her against investors. Remember, they have approximately six investor claims that represent six and one investor with 99 million, and I think another investor with like 9,000. So there's a big spread on the investors, and they could use that defense to say that, well, investors know when they invest in a startup in Silicon Valley that it's fake it till you make it, and therefore these investors knew that what I was saying was puffery, that it wasn't, it was hype, it wasn't a lie. And that's the way Silicon Valley operates. On the other hand, that doesn't really work with doctors and patients, because once they started doing blood tests, it can't be puffery or hype. You're putting someone's life on the line. So I think it could work against some of the investors, although I have seen so many documents and gotten so much testimony that I think it's very clear that they went well beyond puffery and hype. And so I don't think it's going to work. But you know, you got to throw at the wall what you can, and that's what they're going to do.
Well, there's so much more to learn when the trial begins. Reed, Catherine, thank you so much for joining us. And you can hear more of Reed's perspective when Valley of Hype premieres at 5 p.m. Eastern time right here on Yahoo Finance. But before we go to break, here's a preview.
Of course, I have to blame Sonny Belwani and Elizabeth Holmes. I mean, they're the primary two. I mean, they're the co-conspirators who created this mess.
You can't do it alone. She was and is a singular figure, and she does bear responsibility. I mean, even as young as she was, she bears responsibility for what happened under her watch. Look, there's so many other people went along with her. You know, so many other people wanted it to happen. You know, she will say in her defense, you know, it wasn't me alone. And that's true. It's true of every entrepreneur. It's never them alone.
Where do you put Sonny Belwani in all of this?
I think he's really critical. He's the, in some ways, the bad cop to her good cop. And we often, in the case of tech companies, there's, you know, many instances of the man behind the curtain or the more silent partner. And you saw that at Apple with Steve and Steve. You see this at Microsoft with Paul Allen, you know, writing BASIC, and Bill Gates. Elizabeth Holmes was made possible by a broader culture, and her downfall and the attention given to it is also a reflection of the broader culture.
That was Margaret O'Meara. She's a University of Washington history professor and author of The Code. She's interviewed in the film for her expertise on Silicon Valley's evolution. We caught up with Margaret earlier and asked her about the environment that Holmes walked into when she dropped out of Stanford University to try her hand at the region's startup fundraising community. Here's what she had to say.
This is at a moment when Silicon Valley and the world seems to be in love with Stanford and Harvard dropouts and the potential for these very young people to start companies that could potentially change the world. Mark Zuckerberg, of course, is the ultimate poster child for this. Facebook is ascendant. This is before, you know, when Facebook could, you know, was hosting town hall meetings for President Obama when the mood around tech and the exuberance about its possibilities was really running at an all-time high.
So how does Holmes' lineage really fit into the Valley startup culture? Is she similar to some of those people that you just mentioned, her peers, or is she distinctly different?
It's yes and. She's both a product of Silicon Valley and reflection of Silicon Valley's culture. Again, it's a place with a long history of very young, untested founders who are shepherded along by investors and mentors from an older tech generation. But at the same time, she's different. And in one really important way, one real big difference that I think is really important to reckoning with the Theranos phenomenon and Elizabeth Holmes's, but in particular, is she's a woman. And almost every single one of these stories of Silicon Valley entrepreneurs are, they're men, most of them white men. She's not only starting this company at a moment when youth, the Stanford pedigree, all those things are being celebrated and valued, but also right at the moment when Silicon Valley is beginning to reckon with the intense gender disparity that has characterized it from the very beginning. Here comes this young woman, blonde, in a black turtleneck a la Steve Jobs, who seems to be exhibiting these characteristics, but it's a woman. So there's this, you know, in a way she becomes this symbol, kind of carrying all of these hopes and aspirations and this history along with her.
Are there any other parties that bear any level of responsibility for the downfall of Theranos? And if so, which of those parties in your mind should the jury hear about?
So no company is the product of one person. One of the Silicon Valley myths is it over-indexes the importance of people like Steve Jobs or a Bill Gates or these individuals who, of course, their brilliance, their leadership is responsible for a good deal of, you know, the success of their companies, but they don't do it alone. You have other senior leadership that are sharing responsibility, that are also steering the company's direction. You have a board. I mean, that's why these companies have boards of advisors. You have investors. And particularly in the cases of tech companies and Silicon Valley companies that have very young, untested founders, the role of these mentors, investors, these guides in kind of showing that person, the entrepreneur, the ropes, showing them how it's done, encouraging them on a certain path. It's really important. So I'm going to be looking to hear more about who did what when, who knew what when. Elizabeth Holmes certainly was the face of this company. She was the leadership of this company. She embraced that role. She pushed that direction, but she was not, there were a lot of other people involved in this scandal.
So what questions do you still have today about Theranos and Holmes that you hope the trial will answer?
You know, look, we've had some really extraordinary reporting and delving into the Theranos story. And so a lot of answers post hoc have been uncovered. But I think I'd like to see some broader understanding of accountability and responsibility and how this runaway train left the station, you know, how we get from a Stanford undergraduate who's being encouraged by a couple of professors to only a few years later, this enormous company that is just supposed to be, you know, that has all of this, you know, incredibly high valuation, that is hiring out all these people, that is occupying this palatial campus right at the center of the action on Page Mill Road in Palo Alto in the Stanford Research Park. Let's face it, the adults around her, the older, the wiser people, the people with experience in business and in finance and in other realms of leadership, how did the irrational exuberance of Silicon Valley in the 20-teens help create Theranos? And then also, how much did people know that this was not what it seemed, and when did they know it?
And a special thanks to Margaret O'Meara. You can catch more of what she has to say in Yahoo Finance's documentary Valley of Hype, premiering in just a few minutes. But next, I'd like to bring in someone who knows much about raising money in biotech. He's Jeff Hawkins. He's the CEO of Truvian Science, a blood testing diagnostics company that has achieved much of what Theranos set out to do. Truvian also boasts a female co-founder. Jeff talked with us a bit earlier as well.
Yeah, I think let's start with one drop of blood and hundreds of analytes was always science fiction. It still is. It always has been. But there's been a lot of innovation in this field by Truvian and others. So as an example, a desktop analyzer, something that could fit on a countertop or a desktop, and it can do a broad range of testing, that exists. Truvian has one of those machines. It can do about 85% of routine testing. And I know others are working on similar types of analyzers. When it comes to the one drop of blood, one is not feasible, but I think what a lot of us are demonstrating is, you know, two drops, three drops, maybe five, you know, still a very small quantity of blood. And you can do a lot of testing. You could do 20, 30, 40, maybe even 50 analytes worth of testing. So a lot of improvement over what we see today in diagnostics.
So you are based in the San Diego area, and I'm guessing that you're not necessarily immune, though, from Silicon Valley's startup culture and the fundraising culture there. So why do you think that we're seeing so many companies with unproven track records that are achieving these soaring valuations?
Yeah, you're correct, Alexis. We have Silicon Valley investors in our company as well. I think there's a few factors in play. In general, valuations in the markets are up significantly over the last, you know, 5 years, whether public or private markets. I think with all the success of venture companies, so many IPOs, so many M&A exits, you also see more money in venture. And when there's more money in venture, you tend to see more money available early. And, you know, in a late stage company, we look at things like revenue, growth rates, profitability, sort of more tangible metrics to define valuations. When you get early, it's more about the opportunity size, the technology you have, how much risk is left to deliver. So it becomes a little more subjective. And if you add now large amounts of capital, it has much more of a chance of big valuations, because it's sort of finding a way to put all this capital into the company and have the ownership sort of distributed appropriately, I think can sort of inflate the valuations early stage when there isn't sort of that business fundamental to peg it to.
Jeff, why do you think that in Theranos's case, that the group of people that were surrounding Elizabeth Holmes, we're talking about board members, we're talking about investors, talking about the advisors who were really top of their field that were surrounding her at the time she was building Theranos. Why do you think that there wasn't more of a demand put on Elizabeth Holmes and company executives to really come up with proven results before taking a product all the way to market?
Yeah, I think we have to break investors from board members for a minute. So as an investor, with the exception of those who invest and join the board, many investors, the level of data and diligence they do is at the time of investing, and then they're not really involved frequently day to day with the business. Their chance to sort of vote with the data they've seen is at that time of writing a check. And to many investors' credit, they couldn't get the data they needed and they didn't invest. So I think there is, that needs to be sort of said. On the other side, I think your question really hits home with me around the board and other people surrounding her, whether advisors or executives. It's an area that hasn't been well published or sort of reported on. It's an interest of mine. What did they know? Did they ask for data and were they given it? And it just wasn't presented factually and accurately. I think that's the unknown. But the board certainly, I know with our board, they ask for data. They want to see progress. So the board certainly have that type of an engagement with the company. The question is, did they ask and were they given accurate information? The number one for me is, what did the board know and what level of engagement did they have, especially as some of the reports of false results started to come out? So were they asking for data? Were they asking for any independent sort of experts in the field to assess the quality of results and give them a perspective? Sort of, what did they know? And if they knew, what prevented them from acting? Or on the other side, were they asking and they just weren't being given accurate information? So that sort of dynamic of Sunny and Elizabeth with their board and what may have been shared is interesting to me to try to learn more about in this trial. And I hope we do learn about it.
And there's a whole lot of people waiting for answers to those questions. Special thanks to Jeff Hawkins for his insight. We're now just about 10 minutes away from the premiere of Valley of Hype, but stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We're just minutes away from the premiere of Yahoo Finance's first ever documentary film, Valley of Hype. But before that, I want to welcome Maureen Farrell. She's a capital markets reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Her former coworker, John Kerry, first revealed the problems at Theranos. Maureen is also a co-author of The Cult of We. It's a dive into the influences that drove the funding into the also embattled office rental startup WeWork, and its founder, Adam Neumann. Maureen, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I cannot think about Theranos without also thinking of the hype and the letdown at WeWork. And although WeWork remains a going concern and it's based in New York, it's really an example of history already repeating itself and with much bigger dollars attached. So you describe the meltdown as a vital parable of the 21st century economy in your book. So what kind of similarities did you find or do you see between those two companies?
Sure. I mean, there are so many similarities, and primarily it is this true cult of the founder and a wide roster of investors. In the case of WeWork, somewhat different than Theranos, it was, you know, some of the top investors in Silicon Valley and some of the most seemingly sober investors in the world, of Fidelity, T. Rowe Price, but all really buying into the hype around the founder and essentially we kind of compare it to giving teenagers keys to a car, a full tank of gas, no limits on what the founder can do and questions, but no way of really gatekeeping these founders. I think that was the case both with Elizabeth Holmes and Adam Neumann, the CEO and co-founder of WeWork.
Now, there was a recent New York Times piece written by Shira Ovideh, and she questions if these, quote, boundary-pushing executives are an inescapable part of innovation. Do you think that that could be just the case?
It's hard to tell. I mean, I don't think it has to be the case. I think we're in this era where it is the case right now, where these boundaries, it seems like investors are too scared to put boundaries on these founders for fear. It's this whole FOMO culture, fear of missing out on this investment that's going to be the next Amazon, the next Google. I mean, but you look at Amazon, right? One of the biggest companies in the entire world, one of the most innovative companies. And something that sort of built specifically Adam Neumann, this founder control, where you have, where the founders have so much more power and essentially all the voting control of a company. The founder of Amazon, Jeff Bezos, did not have that. Everyone talks about Steve Jobs, Jeff Bezos, and they actually didn't have that. They had some boundaries. If they, you know, if they failed, Steve Jobs famously was pushed out. He learned a lot of lessons and then came back and revived Apple. So I don't think it really has to be part of innovation. I think right now that is the mindset in Silicon Valley, but I don't think it has to be.
Now, I want to switch gears and look at it from another perspective. I want to show a clip from the film, and it's an interview with former Theranos board member Dan Warmenhoven. And then I'd like to get your perspective on the other side of it. Here's what he had to say.
This is going to sound a little strong, but to a certain degree, she's a victim because she didn't know what she didn't know. And she relied on people who gave her bad advice or mismanaged it, I think.
So here, I want your thoughts on whether you think it's possible that founders like Holmes or Neumann or others are really set up in any way to fail.
I think too, first of all, I think that's way too strong to call her a victim. I mean, she knew from everything I've ever read, she knew that didn't work, was putting people's lives in danger. Yet I do think there's something to that I do think makes sense. I think founders are set up to fail. It's unhealthy to not have boundaries on founders and to really just give them so much room to sort of run themselves into the ground. I mean, I think about that a lot. I mean, Theranos, you know, it just didn't work. But WeWork, there was something there. And I think, you know, what if the board member stood up to him and told Adam Neumann he couldn't buy a $65 million private jet, he couldn't loan himself, take out loans and do stock sales worth $1 billion? What if they actually made rules and forced him to stick by them, forced the company, really took a harder look at the company and these very obvious red flags? Could its fate have been avoided? Could it have been, you know, maybe a slower growing, but better, more solid company? So there's something to it. I think Dan Warmenhoven's taking it a bit far in the case of Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos, because I mean, it's just so inconceivable for her to be the victim of it, but there's something there.
Well, we know that Elizabeth Holmes will make a go of it in her defense as her trial begins, that victim idea. So Maureen Farrell, Wall Street Journal reporter, thank you so much for being with us. Your insight is invaluable. We hope you stay tuned for the premiere of Yahoo Finance's brand new documentary, Valley of Hype, The Culture That Built Elizabeth Holmes. You can watch that right here in just about 2 minutes. That's next.
asking yourself whether you're wrong is a really good thing. If you really feel strong conviction that you're doing the right thing, then keep going.
That ideology is shared by some of the world's most ambitious creators who flock to Northern California with a dream. They seek like-minded encouragement to move fast and break things, and even fake it until they make it. Those principles can come at a cost, always for investors, often for entrepreneurs and their employees, and sometimes for the public at large. And for one entrepreneur, once lauded the world's youngest self-made female billionaire, the cost could add up to years in federal prison.
This is Silicon Valley, a hub of innovation that's often coupled with sleight of hand. I'm Alexis Keenan, and this is Yahoo Finance Presents. Nearly $1 billion gone bust, swallowed by the opaque Silicon Valley biotech startup Theranos, whose founder Elizabeth Holmes faces years in prison for a pitch pushed to extremes.
I knew that I could do something that would be different than what everybody else is doing.
She said her technology would revolutionize healthcare, miniaturizing a suite of common blood tests down to a few drops. The technique would democratize diagnostics, driving down cost to make tests so affordable that consumers could access periodic snapshots of their personal health over time. It was a story that Holmes told with unwavering conviction.
If you watched a movie and you took one frame out of that movie, you said, okay, Elizabeth, tell me the story. I would never be able to tell you that story, but if you gave me a series of frames, I could begin to piece together a story.
The concept captivated investors and media and turned Holmes into a startup sensation, though her stardust began to settle when the Wall Street Journal exposed frames of her story as technology overhyped. The reckoning fueled a barrage of scathing news reports, a New York Times bestseller, and a feature documentary, leaving Holmes accused of fraud, of peddling impossible science, and portrayed a vixen.
Her confident charm and even physical appearance were cited to explain why distinguished advisors and hopeful investors in a male-dominated field bought what she was selling. Yet not everyone is convinced that Holmes was just a persuasive pretty face, or that her methods to materialize her vision should be viewed in black and white.
This is going to sound a little strong, but to a certain degree, she's a victim, because she didn't know what she didn't know, and she relied on people who gave her bad advice or mismanaged it, I think.
Even for Theranos, I'm not 100% convinced that it is fraud, although that, I mean, we have lots of leads that many, many, many things were wrong.
The first crazy concept that we had that people said absolutely could not be done, especially when I tried to raise money for the first time to start the company, was wanting to change the way lab testing was done. If you're going to start a company, the first question is why, right? For me, it was, this is a change in the world that I want to see.
The change was never realized, at least not by Theranos. Instead, the company imploded under a raft of lawsuits, regulatory actions, and SEC fines, all targeting Holmes for promising more than she could prove. Yet holding Holmes to both criminal charges and such intense media scrutiny could ultimately be what makes her unique as a Silicon Valley entrepreneur and may overshadow her pioneering role in an emerging biotech field.
The biggest concern I've had with the media was, immediately after Theranos started falling apart, was there was a rumble of people saying, well, this was such a bad idea, this could never happen. Or actually, really, I think Elizabeth's vision was phenomenal, right? And I share the same vision, and so I really resonate with that. I think it is a good idea, and it needs to be, it needs to happen.
It was all doable. I mean, that's the other thing. There wasn't any engineering problem that couldn't be resolved by the time I came in the company. There was refinements. I think with a different board, maybe with a different COO, with somebody to coach her and help develop her as a CEO and a spokesperson, I think a lot of this could have been avoided.
In a culture that handsomely rewards innovators while embracing this fake it till you make it ethos, who deserves to shoulder the blame? Prosecutors say it's Holmes and her former boyfriend and Theranos COO Sunny Balwani for allegedly operating the once hyped blood testing company as a criminal scheme that defrauded investors, doctors, and patients. Others, including one of Theranos's earliest critics, say the answer is not as clear and take into account a system known to conflate optimism with reality.
I suspect that there's many other companies that don't really have the ideas that they propose that they do that they have. They're still working on them. They haven't tested them out. They are probably over-optimistic, and maybe most of these ideas would fail. I don't think that Theranos is an exception in that regard.
If Theranos is no exception, how strongly will criminal accusations hold up? And where will jurors draw the line between an entrepreneur's push for disruption and fraudulent deception?
But I'm sure the courts are going to place a different standard on it than I do. But my standard is, if an entrepreneur makes a claim and you want to invest, it's your obligation to go validate all the claims she's made. She may have made exorbitant statements, but those could have all have been corroborated before the money was invested. And in fact, if somebody had done the work to try to corroborate them, they would have found out they're really exorbitant. They're wishful, and they're futuristic, and they don't represent the present. If you invested based on those claims, you would have said, okay, that's fraud.
If Holmes' strategy was to temporarily fake it, how different were her tactics from her Silicon Valley peers? When did the alleged charade begin? Why did financial backers keep her company afloat for more than a decade? And what lessons should future investors learn? The answers lie in a tangle of conflicting symptoms that can give investors reason for confidence as well as caution in the traditions of seed capital rich Silicon Valley. Disruption often begins like this. An aspiring creator claims their vision for a new reality, then sets out to piece together the missing parts to their puzzle.
What we wanted to change was the fact that when you find out you're sick, you're already too sick in many cases to be able to really change the course of the disease. The way you change that is that you have to reinvent every element of the system, which means you have to reinvent the tests, you have to reinvent the devices, you have to reinvent the software, you have to reinvent the locations through which the testing is provided, the pricing. So this was not a short-term business plan.
And there's one place, perhaps more than anywhere else in the world, that fosters the rapid incarnation of these bold ideas.
This is the Valley of Dreams, right? It's a unique situation. There is no other place in the world where somebody with a big idea can come and have access to capital, have access to all of the corporate services you need to get it off the ground. So people come here with big dreams. And I think Elizabeth had a great big dream.
This region of resources, in its early days known as the Santa Clara Valley, was formed by generations of tech pioneers whose ideas were brought to life with the help of deep pockets.
Silicon Valley was just another little agricultural valley in California through the middle part of the 20th century. And the thing that changed it all was World War II and the Cold War. The government did something that it hadn't done before. In the big way, it got into the research and development business, and particularly put an immense amount of money into research in electronics and computing.
It was decades before the blockbuster successes of Valley Tech icons Steve Jobs, Bill Hewlett, and David Packard when the Valley's founding fathers put the federal government's money to use.
The startup that brought silicon into Silicon Valley was a short-lived operation called Shockley Semiconductor. And the person who founded it was William Shockley. He was a co-inventor of the transistor.
A veteran of telecom behemoth Bell Labs, Shockley realized the power of silicon to miniaturize transistors that by the mid-1950s helped power the world's first microchips.
And so the Valley gets more and more significant in the landscape of tech.
By 1957, Shockley's team founded its own startup, Fairchild Semiconductor. Instead of turning to the federal government, the group made a radical move and looked to the private market, securing funding courtesy of East Coast investment banker Arthur Rock.
Arthur Rock later becomes one of the most legendary venture capitalists in Silicon Valley history.
That same year, the microchip earned a reputation as indispensable as the Soviet Union launched its Sputnik satellite.
The first artificial Earth satellite.
Beating the U.S. into orbit.
This basically lights Washington, D.C.'s hair on fire. And all of this money starts getting invested in rockets and missiles and technologies to get things and people out into space and ultimately to the moon.
In shooting for the moon, the influence of Santa Clara Valley technology and the investment dollars it attracted were forever altered. The region had officially left behind its agricultural roots to become a tech and investment hub. A next generation would prove what silicon could do, not just for big business and government, but for the individual.
Who has all the computers? The establishment, the government, big corporations.
Key players to that independent movement were two Fairchild alums, Bob Noyce and Gordon Moore, who in the late 1960s founded Intel to build memory chips. They too tapped venture capitalist Arthur Rock, whose $2.5 million stake advanced the uniquely American concept of partnering wealthy investors with tech entrepreneurs. The concept would carry into the next millennia to prop up countless enterprising founders, including Elizabeth Holmes.
So once you have a computer on a chip, you can build a wooden box about around it, and it's a desktop computer, and it's under your control. It's not under the university's control or the Pentagon's control. And look, it's Vietnam, it's Watergate. This is an anti-establishment moment in American culture.
That movement gave rise in the mid-1970s to computer enthusiasts Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs. With Noyce's help, Jobs and Wozniak secured funding for a first personal computer, the Apple, through investor Mike Markula, and later through Sequoia Capital, that would evolve into one of the region's most profitable VCs.
The venture capital becomes an important glue between the generations, right? Who are the leading venture capitalists of today? They're people who were, that you know, had these massive exits in the 90s, who in turn were funded and mentored by people who had massive exits in the 80s and 70s.
These generational networks reinforce Silicon Valley's tightly knit circles and its backlash against corporate business as usual.
You can't have total corporate misbehavior in order to be successful, but at the same time, there's this encouragement and cultivation and tolerance of behavior that might get you kicked out of a traditional company. Silicon Valley has a strong sense of itself from the very beginning as not being like other companies. This is a different sort of business. We think different. We do things differently, and we have amazing results as a result.
Even investors have been known to play by their own rules.
The venture capitalists themselves did not want to sue Theranos. And there's a reason for that. It's because they all live in Silicon Valley, and if they sue a company that they've invested in, they're not going to get the next deal.
Plaintiff's attorney Reed Cathrine represented individual investors who did sue Theranos, claiming fraud. Two late-stage minority backers who bought company shares indirectly and complained they relied on false claims. The sole venture capital firm to sue Theranos was one of its largest investors, Partner Fund Management. It brought two lawsuits that ended in settlement.
It's very important for the venture capitalists to be able to get the next deal, to get the next Google, to be able to be one of the first to invest.
That was already a well-established part of Valley culture by the time Steve Jobs comes along. There were lots of arrogant jerks in the semiconductor industry. And part of the culture of the chip makers, the semiconductor makers, was if someone was producing amazing technology, you were kind of going to let them get away with murder.
In hindsight, a predictable setting for the whirlwind ascent of Elizabeth Holmes and for her meteoric fall.
When we began Theranos, what we focused on was creating a customized medicine tool that could be used in the home. The ability to begin bringing monitoring, as we call it, into the home, we believe could fundamentally change the way that both patients are treated as well as drugs are developed.
That was Elizabeth Holmes in 2005, one of the few times early on that she spoke publicly about her ambitions.
I think it all starts with a very unique kind of founder who truly has a passionate, burning conviction that they've come up with an idea that will change the world. And they have the soaring ambition to just be driven to want to make it happen as fast as possible.
Conviction spurred Holmes to drop out of Stanford University. In 2003, the 19-year-old traded in life as a full-time undergrad for life as a full-time CEO.
I'd always believed that the purpose of building something, building a company, is to make a difference in the world. And I got to the point in which I found what I felt like I was born to do.
As if ripped from a playbook for Silicon Valley superstardom, Holmes' early college departure followed in the footsteps of Oracle's Larry Ellison and Apple's Steve Jobs. Another Holmes-era dropout included Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, who in 2004 cut his time short at Harvard.
There was a lot of money left over from the dot-com boom. You have PayPal being acquired by eBay, turning the founders of PayPal, who become known as the PayPal Mafia, into multimillionaires. And that includes people like Peter Thiel, Elon Musk, Reid Hoffman, Jeremy Stoppelman, like all these people who go on to found other companies in the Valley.
Who didn't graduate college and left college at 19 years old? We have Bill Gates, we have Steve Jobs, we have Mark Zuckerberg.
Holmes filed her first patent around the same time she sidestepped her college career. A wearable monitor with skin-piercing microneedles to detect biological red flags and deliver therapeutic drugs. By the next year, in 2005, investment capital was rolling in.
Now, how much money have you raised thus far in venture capital funds?
We raised just over $6 million, and then we've also raised money from private investors.
Factoring for inflation, the figure dwarfed even Apple Computer's first money raise in 1977, a $250,000 investment, much of which was structured as a loan. With many fewer strings attached, investors bet big on Holmes.
So in the beginning, it was Don Lucas, very seasoned venture capital guy. I'm sure I don't know the details, but I know Don's reputation well enough to know he probably did excellent due diligence.
Well, the first guy really was Don Lucas Sr., who had originally been an investor in Oracle. But at this point in time, I think he was sort of not fully paying attention to what's going on.
However well vetted, the apparent confidence was contagious. Billionaire venture capitalist Tim Draper backed Holmes, as did billionaire Oracle co-founder Larry Ellison.
What was fundraising like?
Finding the right people to invest in you, I think, is everything.
To find the right people, Holmes didn't need to look far. Draper had been a family friend, and other deep-pocketed investors traced directly to Holmes' alma mater.
Stanford's biggest, most important product isn't tech, it's people. Look through the whole genealogy of Silicon Valley, starting with Hewlett and Packard, who were Stanford students there in the 30s. And you have access to incredible resources, professors, business people coming to campus. Modern Stanford has become this town square for billionaires, right? It's this place where you rub shoulders with incredibly successful people, and they're telling you, this is how you can be like me.
The exclusive access held another secret to Holmes' initial success. Prominent backers gave rise to an impressive board, including former U.S. Secretaries of State Henry Kissinger, the late George Shultz,
and former Secretaries of Defense William Perry and General James Mattis.
Like, the only person missing from your board is the Pope. How did that happen? Was it like, I'm just going to write to Henry Kissinger? These kind of caliber of people who are in the public eye, but probably not so easy to ring up.
In our case, those were people who I had the privilege of getting to know and in many cases working with for, in some cases, a couple of years before we asked them to join the board.
Once one got on board and was sold by, the others were sold by him. They're all related to the Hoover Institution for the most part.
Which has stocked with former heads of state and very powerful people, people who've had incredible political careers and military careers, who also have, in turn, connections to the business community and instill credibility on a very young, untested person.
For all its privilege, the early board was mostly devoid of expertise in diagnostic testing, biochemistry, and molecular biology.
At least in its initial composition, practically they had no scientists who were relevant to the topic of what that startup was about. They had powerful people who could really sway power across many constituents and probably facilitate investors to send their money to Theranos and open lots of doors and gain publicity. But they had no science. They had no science and they had no board to tell them that they have no science.
One exception was Holmes' college mentor and first director, then Stanford Chemical Engineering Dean and Professor Channing Robertson.
I think he gave the credibility that these investors needed.
I hired the person that I was working for at Stanford. And
that's a wonderful story, isn't it?
Yeah.
Huh.
It was great.
Like entrepreneurs before her, Holmes tweaked her concept along the way. Within 2 years of leaving Stanford, her patent applications included a portable analyzer that would quickly and inexpensively test biological fluids, including blood.
I got interested in blood and lab testing because it's a tool and the ability to dramatically reduce the sample volume that's required for doing lab testing traditionally and dramatically reduce the cost.
Holmes' portable analyzer first became known as the Edison and later as the Minilab. In its first iteration, the device would cater to pharmaceutical companies to test adverse drug reactions in clinical trials. Later versions would serve doctors and patients, replacing the bulk of traditional lab testing altogether.
Instead of having to go to a lab in order to give blood, we're actually going to begin to make it possible for people to do lab testing in the places they need care.
Instead of large needles, vials of blood, and days-long processing times, Holmes envisioned that doctors and patients could draw just a few drops of blood using a fingerstick sample stored in the company's proprietary nanotainer and get immediate results for an array of common blood tests.
The product is meant for an individual to actually conduct a blood test, ultimately at home. And the box is about the size of a printer, desktop printer. So it's probably maybe 18 inches long and 15 inches wide and 12 inches tall.
Holmes' pivot to engineer a desktop analyzer came with a mountain of electrical, chemical, and bioengineering challenges. The vision was so ambitious that critics, including Theranos employees, said it couldn't be done. Added hurdles came from Richard Fuse, a Holmes family friend 30-plus years her senior, who filed a patent to seize upon an overlooked element in the would-be analyzer's supply chain. Holmes later sued Fuse, accusing him of creating the patent with stolen Theranos IP. By 2010, 5 years into her pursuit, there was light at the end of the tunnel. After struggling to stay afloat, Holmes reported to the SEC that Theranos had sold $45 million in private company shares. And a $12 million line of credit came from Holmes' then-significant other, Sonny Belwani, a dot-com-era millionaire who Holmes had recently hired as Theranos' COO.
So I actually think the impact of what we are doing to put the diagnosis right there where the patient is, this invention is going to be way up there. We will have the same impact on human health and medicine as the discovery of antibiotics had.
Belwani and Holmes first became friends in 2002. Belwani was 37 and Holmes 19. The two became a couple after Holmes left Stanford.
She didn't choose Sonny, really. The board made her go hire somebody, and Sonny looked good on paper.
The couple was criticized for going to great lengths to keep their romantic relationship a secret.
That was ridiculous. This is part of the naivete. The way the company found out that she and Sonny were having a relationship, she changed her home mailing address to be his.
She never told the board, and once we began to see the documents and the communications between them, it became very clear.
In an unfruitful deposition, Catherine pressed Holmes to explain.
Can you tell me whether or not you had a romantic relationship with Sonny Belwani?
Again, due to the pending charges by the Department of Justice, I am instructing Elizabeth to invoke her Fifth Amendment rights and not answer.
Did you ever get an answer to those questions?
No. She pled the Fifth.
The partnership continued until 2016, when Belwani left the company. The dynamic is likely to come into focus in Belwani and Holmes' now separately scheduled trials. According to court documents, Holmes intends to introduce evidence concerning her mental state during her time as CEO. In 2013, Holmes and Belwani struck an equally puzzling business partnership. Theranos announced a major deal with drugstore giant Walgreens to deploy the device in its Palo Alto and Arizona stores, despite the device's design for home and doctor's office use. Under a $140 million contract, Walgreens would become the exclusive pharmacy to offer Theranos tests, and someday in more than 8,000 U.S. stores.
Walgreens got enamored with the notion of putting one in every store so that you as a customer could come in and have your blood test done while you shop.
In a carefully worded press release, the company said consumers can now complete any clinician-directed lab test with as little as a few drops of blood, with results available in a matter of hours. It went on to say that blood samples would be drawn either from a tiny finger stick or a microsample using traditional methods. The Walgreens partnership made Holmes a darling of business and tech media. Her story catapulted to the covers of magazines and to the front pages of newspapers. Under Holmes and Belwani's management, in 2014, Theranos' funding spiked to $400 million.
She was on every cover looking her Steve Jobs best. Everyone called her the next Steve Jobs, and it was just wonderful. I mean, I don't know a CEO who wouldn't kill to have that kind of positive publicity.
Wired first reported Theranos' analyzer could perform hundreds of blood tests, and as many as 30 from a single drop. Holmes soon boasted to Fortune that 70 different tests were possible from a fingerstick sample, and that Theranos offered more than 200 common tests. The bold claims elevated Holmes to her first cover feature.
I was the editor, Tim was the story editor, and Roger Parloff was the writer. And we were excited about it. It sounded, you know, just like everyone else said back then. I mean, this was like the next big thing, you know, and there was a lot of enthusiasm about it and a lot of interest, certainly.
It was already a good-sized company with 500 employees. It was represented by David Boies, who at that time was sort of the preeminent attorney in the country. And it had backing from Larry Ellison and Betsy DeVos.
TechCrunch also interviewed Holmes in the peak of her company's ascent.
This is the amount of blood that's needed to draw to do a test.
A lot of private companies were getting a significant amount of funding. So I think valuations were just high across the board, and there was a sense there was a lack of circumspection, I guess, around what was going on in the industry.
Forbes followed suit, publishing a cover feature of its own.
They were kind of saying she may be the next big thing, like visionary, guru, Silicon Valley, big deal, young. A lot of CEOs, sometimes they can be very controlling, and she just had none of that. I think even at that point, Forbes was already telling me that she was apparently America's youngest self-made female billionaire.
The coming out party lasted nearly 2 years, as Holmes purported to disrupt the multi-billion dollar diagnostics industry dominated by companies like Quest, LabCorp, Siemens, and Abbott. Meanwhile, Walgreens customers relied on Theranos-branded tests, and the company's valuation soared to $9 billion. The company grew to more than 800 people on its payroll, including former Apple OS X developer Avi Tavanian, eventually asked to resign from the Theranos board, and chief scientist Ian Gibbons, a 30-year biochemistry expert who in 2013 took his life after receiving a subpoena to testify in the patent dispute with Holmes' former family friend.
There's a little bit of irony in the photograph now. It's like the firehouse catching on fire. What you're seeing in that photograph, it's exactly what is not supposed to happen.
By that time, U.S. attorneys say Holmes was peddling a fraud. The accusation was first waged in an October 2015 Wall Street Journal expose. Reporter John Carreyrou skewered Holmes' claims that her technology could accurately process hundreds of tests using the finger stick technique.
But it really wasn't until John Carreyrou's story in the Wall Street Journal came out that we had any understanding that there was less here than met the eye.
Whistleblowers who informed Carreyrou's reporting compounded the damage, claiming the analyzer returned enough false positive and false negative results that the company was forced to run all but one test on traditional equipment made by the very companies Holmes aimed to disrupt.
Even if you could test blood on third-party equipment, they were diluting that blood on equipment that was not made for diluting that blood. Their defense was, well, we did have the technology, and it was on, not on our box, but it was on third-party equipment in their testing and in their quality assurance and all the things you're supposed to do at a lab. They were, if the numbers didn't work out, they were playing with the samples they used, and it's questionable.
At the heart of the Justice Department's indictment are accusations that Holmes and Belwani lied about Theranos technology to dupe investors and business partners into forking over cash and to dupe patients into paying for Walgreens-based tests. Claims further examined in Carreyrou's nonfiction book, Bad Blood, and in Alex Gibney's documentary, The Inventor.
Well, and the question is, did she know she was perpetuating a fraud, or was there something more mysterious going on? I think she is afflicted with what the police call noble cause corruption, meaning, simply put, it's like the end justifies the means.
Holmes and Belwani's knowledge will be key to their defense, given prosecutors' burden to prove intent, a non-negotiable element required to obtain a conviction.
Well, that's what makes this a difficult story to draw conclusions about in terms of investment fraud, because I don't think anyone disbelieved this story, including Elizabeth Holmes, at the outset.
By 2010, 7 years after Holmes started Theranos, is when U.S. attorneys say she and Belwani began a conspiracy that by 2015 would include lying to investors about the range and accuracy of tests, faking product demonstrations, misrepresenting projected revenues, and fabricating stories that Theranos' device had been deployed in military combat zones. By 2013, prosecutors say the two knowingly promoted and delivered tests likely to contain inaccuracies and falsely represented to investors that the tests did not require FDA approval, a point Holmes has contested, along with pleading not guilty to criminal charges.
When I started, they had scrapped the Edison device, so we were working on the next generation, black box.
It was 2015, a month before Carreyrou revealed what Jocelyn Bailey and other Theranos employees already knew. More than 90% of Walgreens-based tests use neither the mini lab nor tiny blood samples, and instead came from traditional larger volume blood draws processed by traditional analyzers made by Siemens. Bailey's job was to develop immunoassays, a common type of blood test intended to run inside the mini lab.
Did you know about the Siemens machines being used while you were working there?
Yeah, we knew. I think it was communicated to me, yeah. Our team knew about it. I don't know if everyone knew. We knew that finger sticks had been cut real recently from the clinics. Some of those original claims were known. You know, it hurts, but we knew it and we were in the lab trying to make it better.
The revelations turned Fortune's cover story on its head.
It became clear that they couldn't accomplish the tests that they wanted to using the Edison machine. Then, in fairly short order, it unraveled when some of the technicians blew the whistle on her.
One whistleblower, Tyler Schultz, a Theranos employee and grandson to board member George Schultz, disclosed the shortcoming to the Wall Street Journal and filed a complaint with New York State's Department of Health, saying the company had manipulated proficiency testing, a process meant to promote test accuracy. At a minimum, if the Theranos-Walgreens 2013 press release and Holmes' statements to media were to be believed, with as little as a few drops of blood, its device should have been able to accurately process multiple, if not more than 200, common diagnostic tests.
Did it make you question the technology or not necessarily?
You definitely realize that 220 assays on a single drop of blood on the same machine that you developed, that's not feasible. And so you realize if their goal was to have it in all these wellness centers and have the price be cheap and all this kind of stuff, you understood why they were using these commercial analyzers. You didn't realize, I guess, the extent of how much they had pitched their own machine and how the public was understanding that everything was being done on our technology.
When reporters pressed Holmes on the inconsistencies, she admitted that only one fingerstick test was commercially available using the mini lab, a single assay for herpes virus HSV1. The rest, Holmes said, remained in R&D or awaited approval. In 2016, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid notified Theranos of laboratory deficiencies, posing immediate jeopardy to patient health. The agency sanctioned the company and agreed to a settlement, banning Holmes from owning or operating a clinical lab for 2 years. The agreement forced the company to shutter its Walgreens and laboratory operations. Holmes' defense wasn't enough to quiet her most formidable critics. A flood of lawsuits followed. Arizona's attorney general, investors, and the SEC claimed fraud. Walgreens sued for breach of contract, and the Justice Department filed criminal charges for conspiracy and wire fraud.
Did Holmes ever explain to you why she maybe embellished what her product could do?
No, although she didn't have to. You know, it's not uncommon for entrepreneurs in particular to talk in the present tense about the future. My product can do this. Well, your product's not built yet. Your product is a bunch of concept. But nonetheless, the tendency is to say, my product can do this, or my service can unify people. But no, it's a way of essentially describing a future vision. And Elizabeth was very good at that.
Aside from the DOJ's criminal action and a civil suit filed by Theranos customers, Holmes settled the lawsuits out of court. The company paid Walgreens around $25 million to settle its breach of contract claim and separately agreed to pay nearly $5 million to Arizona customers. A $500,000 fine was paid to settle the SEC's claims of fraud. Among other stipulations, Holmes relinquished her controlling stake in Theranos and diverged from Balwani, who continued to defend the SEC's claims. Catherine said his clients recouped their investments. Still, most of the $900 million Holmes raised came from investors who took no legal action against her.
So they all sort of circled the wagons around Theranos and didn't go after him. In fact, they did reach an agreement not to go after him early on.
That overwhelming capitulation by the very investors who prosecutors say were victims of fraud begs closer examination of Silicon Valley status quo and the contributing roles of the parties that power its big ideas.
Of course, I have to blame Sonny Balwani and Elizabeth Holmes. I mean, they're the primary two. I mean, they're the co-conspirators who created this mess.
You can't do it alone. She was and is a singular figure, and she does bear responsibility. I mean, even as young as she was, she bears responsibility for what happened under her watch. Oh, look, so many other people went along with her. You know, so many other people wanted it to happen. You know, she will say in her defense, you know, it wasn't me alone. And that's true. It's true of every entrepreneur. It's never them alone.
Where do you put Sonny Belwani in all of this?
I think he's really critical. He's the, in some ways, the bad cop to her good cop. And we often, in the case of tech companies, there's, you know, many instances of the man behind the curtain or the more silent partner. And you saw that at Apple with Steve and Steve. You see this at Microsoft with Paul Allen, you know, writing BASIC, and Bill Gates.
Anyway, I'm not sure the investors were wrong, because I'm not sure they ever fulfilled their own obligations and responsibilities.
Venture capital, kind of the rule of thumb of VC, is that out of 10 investments, you'll have 3 that fail, you'll have 3 that kind of go, you know, fine, and you'll have 1 or 2 that actually make you money, and sometimes make you a lot of money. And what makes the risk worth it is when you hit big.
The investment money was good eventually, because it gives runway for scientists. So she did a good job at getting some runway later. But the first round of the technology obviously was a massive failure and was terrible for patients. But she did a good job at setting a vision for scientists to work towards, to allow, like, a lot of companies don't have that much funding.
In private company investing, the prospective investor has to fill out a very detailed form that says, I understand the risks. I understand that, you know, I may not get any return on this. I understand, furthermore, this will not affect my net worth.
They're accredited.
They're accredited. Sophisticated, actually, I think is the term. But And nobody did. I mean, they all filled out the form, but nobody did the work. I didn't see them storming the gates and going after the board saying, hey, guys, you know, you got to. In fact, the board was telling Elizabeth, you don't have to do that, which I think she got bad advice.
In announcing its settlement with Holmes, the SEC posed Theranos as a lesson for entrepreneurs, warning that innovators who seek to revolutionize and disrupt an industry must tell investors the truth about what their technology can do today, not just what they hope it might do someday.
I believe that the SEC did not have jurisdiction. I think the SEC has got a great role to play in public markets and all kinds of other things like that. But I'd hate to see them get deep into the venture community and the startup world. It's a fine line between that and, you know, the mom and pop business, believe it or not.
There are some people who say that Elizabeth Holmes is being held to a public company standard. Do you think that that's a valid argument?
I think there's some merit in that. One of the things, particularly the last decade of Silicon Valley, kind of the decade since the Great Recession, that has been different has been the private markets have dominated more than the public markets. Companies would go public. They'd have to go public. I mean, Intel went public when it was 3 years old. Netscape went public when it was less than 2. The way you raise capital was on the public markets. And with that came accountability. And now in the last decade, it's harder to go public, right? New regulations post-recession. It's a heavier lift. And there's been all of this private capital just sloshing through the global markets looking for a home. And then you have this kind of flywheel of storytelling and buzz about, oh, this is the next big thing. And everyone's like, I want to get in on that. Then you're allowed in kind of relative, you're protected from the scrutiny of public markets. Does that mean that you can get away with fraud? No. Investors are right to be, you know, calling her to account.
Warmenhoven said early investors had every opportunity to do just that.
They did nothing in terms of trying to ascertain the current status of the product or the risks to completion or anything else.
Whose fault is that?
I think it's the investor's fault. Yeah, you invest in something. You want to know how your investment is doing. And I think it's also a symptom of the founder culture that has really, you know, really took hold of the Valley exactly during the time that Theranos was growing.
The first meeting I was in was with all the major investors. And they hadn't had any meetings with the company since the round had closed. And, maybe an occasional phone call or something, but nothing as a group, nothing where they got a status report, which I found staggering.
And weren't demanding it?
They didn't seem to press hard before the investment, and they still didn't seem to press hard after the investment. From my viewpoint, it was really out of character for a startup investor not to be all over it. You know, if you were a venture capitalist and you put in $100 million, you would be there every week. How are we doing? Are we on track? You know.
So those documents do not exist.
Not in the hands of the investors. I mean, they were available internally.
Internal documents may have exposed the chasm between Theranos' aspiration and ability, though Holmes told the SEC its investor pitch left room for improvement.
We didn't intend these documents to be standalone, and you know, sitting here now, I know we could have been much better at the way we prepared materials.
And did you talk about specifically the technology and blood draw and what was in place at that time versus what was aspirational? Was there a clear delineation between those two?
We tried to do that.
When we look at Theranos investors, many of them, not necessarily your clients, but certainly perhaps a VC fund, we would expect to be seasoned investors who can properly vet a company, a startup like Theranos.
In this case, probably what you would consider a seasoned investor like Tim Draper, perhaps Larry Ellison and Oracle, they invested early when it was just a concept. And a lot of VCs will invest even when it's not proven. Theranos got well beyond that and then started raising funds, massive amount of funds, over $700 million, from other investors.
The amounts of money that a certain class of what I call mega VCs with untold, unprecedented amounts of capital available to invest, starting with a Japanese company, SoftBank, and some of the sovereign wealth funds in the Middle East who are looking for what to do after the oil begins to peter out, are able to and are bringing amounts of money that have just never been seen before. There's no independent validation. That's what concerns me now when we look at some of these, you know, mega-funded companies like WeWork and Uber, that it hasn't been vetted as much as you would normally hope and expect from at least an independent venture capital set of players. And that adds to the board and the CEO, and here we are.
And they go dig in inside the company and get the facts. Start with Channing Robertson. Start with the head of engineering, you know, and start asking questions.
In addition to Holmes, it was Channing Robertson who in 2016 gave Warmenhoven confidence to join Theranos' board, even after media and lawyers had accused Holmes of fraud.
And he had just concluded organizing two, we call it blue ribbon panels, one that looked at the science of the biochemistry inside the box, and another one looking at the mechanical nature of the box to make sure that it was all viable and doable, and they both came back very positive. So I didn't get in deep to understand how far they were from go-to-market, but I did have enough confidence that the fundamentals were sound.
He clearly thought that she was special, and when she felt like starting a company, he's the one she went to.
He was being paid quite handsomely to work for her, and had a desk in their offices. And he claimed that he didn't know about that technology, and he claimed that he didn't know about the fact that that things didn't work. He claimed he didn't know things were being run on third party equipment. I don't know what the heck was going on with him. Why he wouldn't ask these questions? Why he claims to have been completely in the dark? And he's the one that brought her around, got her credibility, and was paid handsomely, annually.
One former board member reportedly did ask the hard questions. According to ABC, Avi Tavanian, software engineer and former right-hand man to Steve Jobs, was asked to resign in 2007, following his ultimatum that Holmes be replaced as CEO.
The way that startup boards are usually, they're made up of venture investors, and they're made up of other people with domain expertise. And, you know, at the early stage, later stage, corporations may, you know, look even more widely for people who have domain expertise in politics and statecraft. Sure, because they have domain expertise in understanding how large organizations can run and interact with the rest of the world. Something's off from the very early stage.
I would say there was a lack of scientific mentorship overall. It was the assay teams, and that was it. There was little other science guidance given to the actual scientists.
So even Channing Robertson was not interacting with your group?
No, he wasn't present as far as I could tell.
That did set Theranos apart from the very beginning, and it was a red flag to other potential venture investors in the tech and particularly the biotech space. It's a biotech company that doesn't have the personnel or the procedures in place that a biotech company would need to have even at the very beginning stage to develop product.
In 2016, Theranos finally impaneled a medical board. And under new leadership, Holmes presented a scaled-back version of its updated device, the MiniLab, to the American Association for Clinical Chemistry.
There's clearly been a lot of interest in your company. I would argue that a lot of that comes from the fact that there were these claims that were made that were very broad early on. 70 tests, the whole, you know, panoply of lab tests from a couple drops of blood. And the evidence that you presented fell far short of that. So how should we think about that?
Well, I think we fully understand in picking this place to come to introduce it that we have a lot of work to do to engage with this community. And, I mean, I can tell you, I wish that I had started earlier in the context of building the scientific and medical board that we've had the privilege to build.
Under legal pressures and burning cash, the effort would prove too late.
Should the board have looked at its own composition and said, perhaps we don't have the level of expertise that's required for a revolutionary healthcare company?
Yes, but, you know, you're asking people to admit their own weaknesses. You know, let's give credit to Elizabeth Holmes. She was quite the charmer, and people just felt great and important. You know, in their own minds, I'm sure they thought they were providing good sage counsel. But yes, of course, that should be a part of the equation as well.
Stanford Medical School professor Dr. Phyllis Gardner reportedly critiqued fingerstick draws as an impossible source from which to glean accurate results for hundreds of tests. She described Theranos investors as crazy and its board members as old men whose brains had gone to their groin. Yet the suggestion that Holmes' concept was nothing more than fantasy fails to account for a flood of diagnostic startups surfacing in her wake. Take Genolite and its Maverick analyzer that's FDA approved and on its way to running more than 100 common tests from a tiny drop of blood.
Over here is our proprietary technology. So this is a machine we just got cleared from the FDA. And what it's really good at is running, analyzing blood proteins. Nobody else has a machine that can analyze a large number of blood proteins in 15 minutes on the whole blood in a physician setting. So that's our ambition.
The Maverick can perform much of what Holmes envisioned. The device features a proprietary optical silicon sensor that detects color changes in light when it's exposed to targeted blood molecules. For now, blood comes from a low-volume draw taken from a patient's arm. And next is the FDA's decision for the Maverick to perform about 200 common diagnostic tests from a finger stick.
It is a politically charged topic to operate off of a finger stick. What you'll see when we take the blood out of the tube is we're going to take a tiny fraction of one drop of blood.
Okay.
So we've validated that our machine works on less than a drop of blood. We're going to add less than a drop of blood to it.
Less than a drop?
Yeah. So it's about 4% of one drop that we use.
In late 2020, the Maverick was also granted emergency use authorization to diagnose SARS-CoV-2, also known as COVID-19. It's one of 28 approved coronavirus and flu tests that can all be performed from a finger stick.
Eventually, how many tests are you hoping that Genolite will be capable of performing on one device?
That list is well under 200 tests. It's really about 100 tests comprise the vast majority of that. And there's only a few of those that we can't do. We can get to 95% of all commonly ordered tests in 15 minutes.
So what do you have to say to the critics who said Theranos' vision was science fiction?
Well, I think you just saw it happen in the other room.
So this is what the future looks like. A small sample of blood can perform hundreds of tests.
Exactly.
While not every test can be accomplished using a tiny drop of blood, the advancements show Holmes may have had the right concept and the right story without enough technology at the right time.
there's, you know, a difference between the idea and the execution, you know, clearly. But decentralization of diagnostics and getting more data into the hands of doctors when they're making decisions is vital.
Beyond Genolite, investment in miniaturized diagnostics hardly dried up when Theranos was forced to close its doors. Similar startups have been proving the concept as anything but science fiction. There's Athelas, a Sequoia-backed in-home blood testing device, touting technology to detect white blood cell count, viral infections, and cancer from a single drop. And Truvian's portable benchtop analyzer takes 5 drops of blood to deliver multiple assays within 20 minutes. If the latest technology is living proof that Holmes' concept was sound, where exactly was her Achilles heel?
If she had dialed it back and was straightforward about using commercial analyzers and was straightforward that, you know, this is about access, this is about getting patients' blood draw somewhere else and like that kind of stuff, and said that, and we're working on our finger stick technology, we're working on this, then, you know, we could have gotten there, most likely.
This is an epic fail of a perceived, a self-inflicted need for speed that proved to be, you know, very dangerous and fatal to the company, and we could have had an entirely different story. And on top of this, we have to do it at breakneck speed. And this was a case where literally and figuratively speed kills.
It's easy to blame the people involved. It's easy to say, oh, you investors, you should have known better. Like, you should have looked more closely. But the hype machine is powerful. The magazine covers are powerful.
Maybe if enough people don't want to dig deep enough, because we all want to believe, we'll prop them up, we'll put them on the cover of magazines, and they can just plow forward. And maybe eventually they'll make it, or maybe not. But there definitely is a public hunger for that kind of celebrity.
Nearly a year before the journal's expose, John Ioannidis published a critique of Theranos and other well-funded healthcare startups for a lack of peer-reviewed data and for keeping their intellectual property too close to the vest.
Theranos had published practically nothing. That they had a couple of papers, but they were not relevant to their technologies. So there are several unicorns out there with very high valuations, with very little or no evidence that is supported by peer-reviewed publications.
Why is peer-reviewed publication so important, in your opinion?
This is how science is run. This is how we can put trust that something has merit, that something is real, that something can be scrutinized by other scientists and be proven, or at least sustain some criticism and show that that it is relatively bulletproof.
Holmes' sleight of hand didn't go entirely unnoticed. Fortune's editorial team did note limits to their account.
Have this sentence in the original piece that was published in June of 2014. It said, quote, "Precisely how Theranos accomplishes all of these amazing feats is a trade secret." So what does a journalist do from there?
It's difficult to cover proprietary technology. What do we really know about Facebook's algorithms, and how far can we go in there? Well, some of it is ultimately a trade secret.
So it's an unproven proprietary technology, particularly as it pertains to something as sensitive as healthcare, that we probably should have been more skeptical about or had more questions about. And I think it's a great lesson.
Just because someone is claiming they're doing it doesn't mean that the media and the investment community and everyone else should just believe them. And it's often harder for the media because they don't have the same amount of time or necessarily the technical depth. Whether it's the media, investors, or customers, everyone needs to do the work and make sure that what they're doing is they're getting into bed with someone who's doing a good job.
And look, it's not just the media. The media consists of the people who produce it and the people who read it, right? And then when it all comes crashing down, we rush out to buy the books, we rush out to watch the documentaries, we sort of salivate over the, oh, you know, look at all, what a fraud, you know, those silly people. And so we kind of delight in the failure stories as well as the successes, and it does become hard to put it in context and see the broader facts and say, well, this was a manifestation of a bigger problem.
While Theranos' purported trade secrets were walled off from journalists and outsiders, another party, aside from investors and the board, had power to probe deeper. According to Walgreens, in March 2010, Holmes and Belwani pitched Theranos devices to Walgreens company executives as viable and consumer-ready, and said its technology had been comprehensively validated by 10 of the 15 largest pharmaceutical companies.
Do you place any blame there?
I place huge blame with Walgreens, but it's more on the negligence side. I don't believe that Walgreens knew what was going on, but they should have known what was going on. It's almost inconceivable to me that they didn't know that things were being run on third-party tests.
Somehow things got embellished. There was never any concept anywhere in reality that they could do 150 tests with one drop of blood. It was they could do different panels of tests with each other drop of blood. Part of it was how Elizabeth talked, but part of it was what people wanted to hear. Wow, this is amazing, you know? But the truth was, rather than getting three or four vials of blood taken, it would be a very small sample. And in fact, a sample could be normally a finger prick, and you could just get the drop of blood, let's say, off your thumb or whatever, and have no need to poke a vein. So there's a lot of good things to it, but somehow the one drop of blood, that's what got put in the machine. But, you know, to do the whole panel, do that, I mean, 150, probably would have taken 25, 30 drops of blood.
In a deposition before the SEC, Holmes admitted that Theranos had kept Walgreens in the dark over FDA concerns that the nanotainer had been underclassified. Yet she maintained the move away from fingerstick tests was no secret.
Walgreens was operating with us in the store, so they would have known locally that we were doing venipuncture to the extent we were doing venipuncture.
Do you have a general sense of what Walgreens was concerned about following the publication of the article?
I think there were multiple issues. One was they were reacting to the press in general, but then the other was that we hadn't disclosed the engagement with FDA with them to them yet, before it was in the press.
Holmes argues that because the FDA engagement had to do only with nanotainers and because it began months and in some cases years after soliciting investors, it can have no bearing on the government's claims of fraud.
Once the Walgreens conclude we can't get this deployed in the store, from Theranos' viewpoint, they just should have said, time out. What you want to do doesn't fit our architecture, our product strategy, nothing. But that's really kind of where they took the left turn that sent them right in the ditch.
Red flags did spook world-renowned medical center Cleveland Clinic. It bailed on a partnership after Theranos left its due diligence requests ignored. And Walgreens competitor Safeway also withdrew its plans for a pilot program.
Was that the value add for Theranos? Was $140 million up front?
It got them on the map in a hurry. But the Walgreens deal gave it credibility. And so, you know, it helped them basically raise the money they were looking for. You know, that kind of proposal, something of that size or magnitude, should have been reviewed at the board in depth. And you know, there were enough people on the board to say, wait a minute, you know, this is not us.
In deposition testimony, board member Schultz and retired U.S. Navy Admiral Gary Roughead said they did not question Holmes or anyone else at Theranos once public concerns were raised about Theranos' use of third-party technology.
The board had some very competent people and experienced people, good operating people in some ways, and they should have called a halt. I'm not sure it was ever fully discussed at the board. And Elizabeth, as CEO, right, had the right to turn it down or to take it to the board.
And what about Sonny Belwani? What was his role as you understood it?
I never met Sonny. Mm-hmm. He'd been dismissed from the company before I showed up. Elizabeth was the chief architect, and she led most of the engineering program, but Sonny led all the rest of the operations.
Veterans of Silicon Valley startups know that faking it can be fair game.
Many of these companies start an idea, they think that they have it, actually they don't, but they hope that they will develop the working idea while they're pursuing it. And they have that expectation that let's go ahead and it will kind of get itself together and it will be successful. This is not fraud. I mean, you know, this could be seen as visionary. The distinction between fraud and visionary is very subtle here.
These high-risk, high-reward gambles have been taken by some of the most famous visionaries. And even the inventor who inspired Holmes' first prototype, Thomas Edison.
He was the original fake it till you make it guy. Now, he was different than Elizabeth Holmes in that he ultimately did make it. He was an inventor who got it right. And along the way, when he was having trouble with the incandescent light bulb, he didn't let anybody in on that. He faked demonstrations. He was not so dissimilar from other famous people in Silicon Valley, like, say, Steve Jobs, who was a notorious liar. But also a great storyteller. So she's in that tradition, and that's what makes Elizabeth Holmes interesting.
Was she an out-and-out fraud, or was she, you know, just in the great tradition of Thomas Edison and Steve Jobs, you know, faking it till she made it? And it could sort of be a little bit both.
She's part of a tradition of fake it till you make it, which to some extent is celebrated in Silicon Valley, but not so much when it comes to medical devices that can actually affect the health of people.
Is there a certain point with respect to Theranos where you say that's where things went wrong?
I think that there was a gradient going down the tubes. And it's hard to say which specific decision was the worst. I believe that here my response would be biased. I think the decision to move to patients was probably the worst, without having something that was mature. Because once you move to patients, then you're exposing people to risk.
In pushing a soft-baked healthcare pitch, Holmes isn't alone. In its early days, Silicon Valley biotech company 23andMe was ordered by the FDA to immediately discontinue marketing its widely publicized cheek swab test after making unsubstantiated claims that the company could identify risk levels for a number of diseases. A consumer class action lawsuit followed, and the company settled with complaining customers. Diagnostic startup Ubiome was dropped from CVS after federal investigators and an FBI raid of its San Francisco headquarters. In 2021, the company's co-founders, Jessica Richman and Zachary Apt, were accused by the SEC of defrauding investors and indicted by the DOJ for money laundering and securities fraud. Even the FDA and experienced megacorporations have been known to get it wrong. The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists found in 2018 that over the prior decade, 80,000 global deaths and nearly 2 million injuries were linked to faulty medical devices. Take FDA-approved vaginal mesh, implanted in approximately 10 million women worldwide, before the agency banned U.S. sales over risks including organ perforation, protrusion, and death. Its manufacturers, among others, Boston Scientific, Johnson & Johnson, Coloplast, and C.R. Bard. And healthcare giant Bayer was forced by the FDA to restrict sales of its permanent birth control device, Esure, after reported complications involving device migration and death. This widespread imprecision is evidence that as the next biotech billion is already being raised and spent, from startups to multinationals, there's much to be learned and improved.
Elizabeth Holmes was made possible by a broader culture. And her downfall and the attention given to it is also a reflection of the broader culture. You know, there still are investors out there hunting down, you know, who's the next bright young person, man or woman, who's going to have the world-changing product.
I think that we have a lot to learn from understanding what happened with Theranos. But I wouldn't like us to lose the bigger picture. The bigger picture being that there's hundreds of companies out there that may be like Theranos eventually, many of them.
How do investors who want and care about getting accurate information out of a very opaque company, where should they look?
You know, I'll tell you, all this stuff scares me. And then there's a lot of stuff in Silicon Valley, actually, technical stuff, chip companies, telecom, even medical stuff that people don't understand. I urge people to make sure they understand. And it's, you know, sometimes it's not 100% possible. You can make a rule with yourself. So I don't really understand it. I'm not going to invest in it.
Whether founders can back up what they boast, may depend on how vigorously interested parties demand to look behind the curtain.
I mean, there are several checks and balances, and it could be the press, it could be the board, it could be investors. Theranos was a case where all of those entities let down their guard because the story was so great, and they believed in the mission, and they believed that success would be around the corner until it wasn't. There's a cautionary tale to be looking a little deeper into the underlying economics. I think boards clearly have to be more vigilant than they've been.
I mean, ask if it is a secret, but 90% of the time, I think in Silicon Valley, they're going to tell you it's a secret.
Now, a lot of these biotech startup companies, their IP is very important to them and they want to protect it.
There's indeed some tension between IP and peer review disclosure. With patents, it's possible to protect IP and at the same time allow someone to disclose sufficient information.
Even with patents and peer review, biotech founders and their funders may need to take a few leaps of faith.
You always think when you start a new science project, you don't know what the unknowns are. And so that naivete of not knowing what roadblocks you're going to hit, what you're going to have to solve along the way, I think that has a long way to go with being an innovator, right? The naivete, they joke, is a really important piece of innovation.
Yeah. You need money in science. You need a lot of it. But you don't know if it's going to work, but you need guidance.
We don't want to get rid of visionary people. We don't want to get rid of people who really take a shot at a very high-risk idea. We don't want them to think that if they do that, they're just going to end up in jail. We want them to take the best shot, but we also want to have some transparency about what is being done.
Just how much transparency is demanded of future visionaries may also depend on how much light the Justice Department shines on private markets by way of Holmes and Belwani.
A lot of entrepreneurs would love to have that much money. Why do you think that Theranos chose not to just keep its head down and keep the research going?
Once you've gone public, and you've got this dialogue and mantra, and there's all this momentum that you have to maintain, it's very hard to turn that off and go into stealth mode again for a period of time. So there was really, that's a big part of it.
I think Elizabeth had a great big dream. I don't think there was any governors put on her, no speed limits. But that's the case with a lot of people. Some work out, some don't. She made some bad decisions, too. She's not home free. But I always felt like she was fully committed to try to deliver the product and make the company successful, and to do that with all the energy she had. And she gave it her all. To a certain degree, like I said, I know people are going to laugh when they say, how is she a victim?
Do you see Elizabeth Holmes at all as a victim of this culture?
I think to some degree she is. I mean, look, she was and is so young.
There's two ways that we can look at Theranos. One way is to say that it is a bad apple and that the people involved, the CEO or whoever else, were psychopaths and bad people, and they were cheating and it's all fraud and everyone else is wonderful and perfect. In a way, there's some sort of recall bias, to use a scientific term. If Elizabeth Holmes had managed to pull this off and get the technology up and running and develop something that worked, everybody would consider her a hero, the most famous person of the 21st century probably.
If I were fired or I had to start this company over a lot of times in order to figure out how to get this right, I would, right? And I would just do the same thing over and over again.